From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The lobbying scandals and Senate debate about lobbying reform have called attention to the K Street Project, a Republican initiative to pressure lobby groups to hire Republicans and support a conservative agenda. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the K Street Project with James Thurber, director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Also, a conversation with novelist Hilma Wallitzer. Her new novel, The Doctor's Daughter, is about a middle-aged woman who awakes one morning knowing something is terribly wrong, but isn't sure whether it's her marriage, her children, or her father's Alzheimer's disease that's causing that feeling of dread. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The lobbying scandals and the Senate debate about lobbying reform have called attention to a Republican initiative known as the K Street Project, led by influential Republicans, including Grover Norquist and Tom DeLay, who won his Texas primary race yesterday. The K Street Project has pressured lobby groups to hire like-minded Republicans and support a conservative agenda. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid called for an investigation into the project, describing it as having created a culture of corruption that has allowed political operatives like Jack Abramoff to flourish. With us to talk about the K Street Project is James Thurber. He's a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Thurber has testified on lobbying before the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration. What were the goals of the K Street Project when it was created?
The primary goals of the K Street Project were to make sure that people on K Street, that's where lobbyists are in Washington, D.C., and associations are there, that those associations and firms hire Republican staff members and former Republicans rather than Democrats. It was a way for the leadership, especially in the House of Representatives, to build a triangular relationship between the leadership in the House, Republican leadership, people on K Street that represented interests, and to gain a campaign contributions from those individuals in associations and firms that would go to Republicans to help them get reelected.
Now, the goal of the Republicans who started the K Street Project was, one of the goals was to make sure that the lobby groups hired Republicans in all of their staffing positions. My understanding is that the Republicans who organized the K Street Project not only wanted to make sure Republicans were hired, they wanted to make sure no Democrats were hired and that any Democrats who were on staff weren't on staff a whole lot longer. How did they go about doing that?
They had a list of people that they endorsed for jobs, that of people leaving the Hill, and they also had a list of people who were loyal, of course, in the Republican Party that were members of the House and the Senate. And you should know that 43% of the members of the House and the Senate since 1998 have become lobbyists. And so the Democrats that left didn't fare as well as the Republicans. There were some very visible fights over Tom DeLay telling associations that they needed to hire a Republican rather than a Democrat. I will not go through the list, but they were well known here in Washington, D.C. And the message went out that if you really wanted to be effective in terms of access and influence on Capitol Hill, you better hire a Republican as the head of an association or in the firm. Yes, Democrats were there, but you better have a whole lot of Republicans. And that fit into the campaign finance area, in the sense that those individuals then were asked to bring in a certain amount of money to help the Republicans. There was a great deal of loyalty in the relationship.
So the leadership of the K Street Project wanted lobby groups to hire only Republicans in new positions or in replacement positions. Were the lobby groups punished in any way if they didn't go along, and if they hired a Democrat or if they hired a Republican who wasn't considered a Republican that had signed on to the program?
If a lobby firm that was hired for contract lobbying, that's different than an association, didn't really clean up its act quickly enough, in other words, bring in more Republicans or fire some Democrats, they were locked out. They were not able to go in and talk to the chairs. They were not able to talk to the leadership about what they wanted. If they wanted an earmark, a special spending program for a narrow project in there for a client, they were not allowed really in to talk to the Republican subcommittee chairs of appropriation. So it was quite effective. And the discipline was phenomenal in terms of making sure that that happened.
Several of our guests have pointed out that lobbyists have taken a more active role in actually writing legislation than ever before. What role, if any, did the K Street Project play in that?
Lobbyists have always had influence in writing legislation. They lobby to have provisions put into legislation. They actually have entire bills that they give to members. Of course, only members can introduce them. The K Street Project placed people with great expertise from the Hill in lobbying positions, people who used to help draft legislation for members or actually the members themselves. And so with that expertise, they were able to draft amendments and legislation and give them to members and to staff members on the Hill to consider. And in effect, they were writing the legislation. It was being introduced by people still working on the Hill. And because they had such close relationships, they in effect were writing the bills before they were introduced.
Well, what's in it for legislators to let lobbyists write the bills that the legislators should be writing? Is it money?
Well, I think that the primary reason that happens is that people get very busy on the Hill. Staff do, members do. And if there's a trust relationship, a reciprocal trust relationship with someone who's a lobbyist, that saves them a great deal of time. They know that they trust the judgment of that individual, and so that they will take that draft and they'll look at it, maybe take it to legislative council, have it reviewed, and then they'll introduce it. They'll introduce it because they don't have time to draft it themselves. They don't have enough expertise in a particular area, and it helps them immensely.
Do you have a favorite example of a piece of legislation that was really written by lobbyists?
Well, the earmarking process is really, in many cases, legislation written by people off the Hill that are lobbying for a very narrow project for a state or a corporation or a congressional district. The actual language gets written by a lobbyist. It's sent up during the lobbying process, handed to people. And last time there were thousands of these earmarks for $53 billion in the last cycle of spending. And that doesn't include tax earmarks and authorization earmarks.
You want to explain what earmarks are?
Yes, earmarks are, it refers to agriculture in the United States where there's a little tag on the ear of a cow or a pig or sheep to say who owns it. An earmark in the legislative process is a provision, obscure, non-transparent, that's written into an appropriation bill or a tax bill or an authorization bill to say that a particular thing must happen, and that thing is, let's say, fund two bridges in Alaska to nowhere or a bunch of projects for West Virginia. And in the case there, Stevens from Alaska was chairman of the Appropriations Committee, and he had a lot of earmarks for projects in Alaska in the surface transportation bill. Senator Robert C. Byrd earmarks things for West Virginia without any deliberation, any transparency, without a vote. It just gets added, and added sometimes at the conference stage. That means the bill under consideration has passed the House and the Senate. It goes to a conference, and they have to make sure that the bill is identical for the House and the Senate, so they have a conference between the House and the Senate. There are earmarks that are added to the conference bill that have not been considered in the House or the Senate, written by lobbyists, to have specific provisions for universities, for roads, for corporations, and they just get included late at night in a non-transparent way. Now, the House and the Senate want to do something about this, and we'll see in the future whether they will try to limit those kinds of earmarks. It looks like they will.
My guest is James Thurber. He's a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is James Thurber. He's a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University, and one of his issues is lobbying. Let's get back to the K Street Project. Who were the founders of it?
the founders of the K Street Project, were the leaders of the Contract with America that were elected in the 1994 election. In 1995, the Republicans took over the House of Representatives, and Newt Gingrich was the face of the K Street Project in the House of Representatives. And shortly thereafter, the later majority leader, Tom DeLay, took over the K Street Project. The idea started off of the Hill by conservatives in the Republican Party that said, hey, wait a minute. When you look around Washington, all the lobbyists seem to be Democrats. That doesn't make sense. We're in power now. We need to have Republicans in K Street connecting with Republicans on the Hill. So it started in 1995, but it also, in some ways, has been around for many, many years, because anyone in power who is leaving the Hill and wants to stay in Washington, D.C., thinks about the possibility of lobbying, including staff members as well as members of the House and the Senate. And so there has been an informal network of trying to hire people off the Hill into associations, into lobbying firms, because they know a lot about the Hill, they have a lot of friends, and that's been going on for 30, 40 years.
Now, Grover Norquist was also, or is also, one of the leaders of the K Street Project. Grover Norquist is the head of Americans for Tax Reform. He's been close to President Bush, is my understanding, and has led weekly, very influential meetings of conservatives. What has his role been in the K Street Project?
Grover Norquist claims he is the creator of the K Street Project. I'm uncomfortable saying that it was only Grover Norquist. I think that there were staff members on the Hill associated with Newt Gingrich that also had some influence on that. Grover Norquist is a very conservative Republican, especially on taxes, and he felt that if you were going to push his agenda of cutting taxes, starve the beast, as he says, cut off money, resources to the federal government because he thinks large government is bad, the best way to approach that, he said, is to starve the power of Democratic lobbyists on K Street, or any lobbyist that didn't go along with that agenda. So he then and to this day has had some influence on the K Street Project. He likes it. Yes, he's close to the president, President Bush. He's close to the leadership in the House. He has made certain public statements that have embarrassed people lately, so he's somewhat less important as he was, say, 2 years ago.
Now, what pressure could he put on lobby groups to play ball? You know, he's not a congressman. He's not writing legislation. He's not voting on legislation.
Grover Norquist put pressure and still attempts to put pressure on associations and lobbying firms in town by his influence through the Speaker and the leadership of the House of Representatives, in particular, less so in the Senate, and by his reputed relationship with Karl Rove, who is assistant to the president that's very powerful, and to the president himself. By using that reputation of relationship, he had more power, and he could subtly say, and therefore sometimes threaten associations if they didn't hire somebody. He certainly would let other people know that that was a problem. And in fact, there are some cases where he's done so.
What has Senator Rick Santorum of Pennsylvania's role been in the K Street Project?
Senator Santorum has been closely related to the K Street Project. He's been an organizer of it in the House. He's now in the Senate. This has become a problem for him, so he's backed off of it. He's on the Senate Rules Committee, and he in fact, backed the idea of, quote, banning the K Street Project. And one of the reasons for this, of course, is he's in a very tough race in Pennsylvania, and he has been accused of cronyism and ethical lapses as a result of the K Street Project.
So he's now talking about banning the K Street Project, but how much of a part of it has he been?
I think he's been a central part of the K Street Project. He helped have regular meetings of the Republicans where they would pass around a list of people who were leaving the Hill, and that they would bring in lobbyists from K Street to be in those meetings on the Senate side on federal property to talk about how can you help out Mr. Smith and how can you help out Ms. Smith because they're leaving and they're loyal staffers up here. We like them. How can you find a position for them? He played a key role in making that linkage through regular meetings with lobbyists and producing a list of people that they endorsed for jobs on K Street.
The new House Majority Leader, John Boehner of Ohio, who replaced Tom DeLay, campaigned for Majority Leader on the promise that if he were elected, there would be no K Street project or anything else like it. Has he made any moves in that direction of eliminating anything like the K Street project?
Majority Leader Boehner, when he was running for the office, and it was a very competitive situation, was all for many reforms, not only banning the K Street project, but curbing excessive privately funded travel, slowing the revolving door of members, strengthening oversight and enforcement and disclosure. The day he was elected and he came forward, he had a transformational experience. All of a sudden, he wasn't for reform anymore, and he felt that things were pretty good and that they really didn't need to have a lot of reform. That is a battle going on inside the House of Representatives now. Those who feel that they need to have reform and those in the power structure that seem to be backing off of reform. The K Street project is part of that. We have not heard anything from the House about banning the K Street project from the leadership.
What's left of the K Street project now? I mean, there's been major investigations into lobbying. Tom DeLay, who was one of the leaders of the K Street Project, is no longer House Majority Leader. So have the investigations into lobbying made it more difficult for the K Street Project to operate?
The scandal and the individuals breaking the law and going to jail and the ethical lapses, if you want to call them that, by members, staff, and lobbyists in Washington have changed the environment of lobbying. And one of the aspects of changing the environment of lobbying is I think the K Street Project is very weak, if not broken. There are no longer regular meetings on Capitol Hill where you have the K Street Project as a agenda item and you're talking about placing people in jobs. And that's not because there's a ban. That's just because members aren't doing it anymore. And there are many firms who are fundamentally influenced by the K Street Project. That's not changing rapidly, but the firms feel, I think, more freedom to hire the best person, say, on trade policy rather than the best Republican on trade policy. And I see some indications then that the K Street Project is really broken, and it's certainly very weak. And it's broken and weak because of all of the scandals surrounding lobbying, which ultimately pointed to the K Street Project.
You know, we hear a lot about the revolving door, that a lot of congressmen and senators who leave office end up in the lobbying world because the worlds work together, and the expertise and influence that they have as ex-lawmakers would serve them very well as lobbyists. But you've pointed out that the revolving door works the other way, too, that a lot of lobbyists end up running for office. In fact, you made a list of how many people currently in the House or Senate are former lobbyists. So what's the answer? How many?
At this point, there are at least 12 individuals who used to be lobbyists that are now members of Congress. And beyond that, there are literally dozens of senior congressional staff that used to be lobbyists that are senior staff. And then beyond that, they leave the Hill and they go back to the lobbying firms or associations. So the revolving door is two ways. It's on the Hill and it's off the Hill. And I think this is a problem.
Why?
I think it's a problem because these are public servants. These are people who should represent the wider public, and there's a question of conflict of interest. There's a question of trust in the institution. If people think that these individuals are representing narrow special interests that they represented before they get to the Hill, an example of a former lobbyist that became a senator is Senator Thune from South Dakota, a Republican. who represented railroad interests before he came to the Senate. He introduced very focused and narrow provisions to help a particular railroad out in South Dakota, but other railroads, in a larger surface transportation bill when he was in the Senate. And it was almost identical to what he was doing in terms of advocating before he got to the Senate. I think there's a problem there. I think that there is a conflict of interest. He had, in fact, in my opinion, an economic stake personally in this because he was making hundreds of thousands of dollars representing the railroads before he got into Congress. And I'm sure that there was a feeling of reciprocity and obligation to those interests after he got in. He wasn't representing a wider public, the public interest, when doing this. I think that's a problem.
There's a law that says a legislator has to wait a certain amount of time before leaving office and becoming a lobbyist. Is there any reverse law that regulates how long a lobbyist has to wait before becoming a lawmaker?
There's a waiting period of 1 year for members and senior staff in Congress before they can become a lobbyist. And there is no waiting period in that revolving door from being a lobbyist to become a legislator. Some people have talked about regulating that. I doubt very much if that will happen in the near future. In fact, there's no legislation pending with respect to that.
James Thurber is a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Count of Monte Cristo. Introduced by Luc Sant, available in stores and online. And from TIAA CREF, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greatergood. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hilma Wallitzer published her first novel when she was in her mid-40s. Coming up, we talk with her about her latest novel, The Doctor's Daughter. It's about a woman who wakes up one day with an indefinable anxiety and begins to examine the pieces of her domestic life for clues. Also, more on lobbying with political scientist James Thurber. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with James Thurber, distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. We're talking about lobbying and lobbying reform. Lobbyists have been playing a bigger role in campaigning. I think you touched a little bit on how they've been doing that, but could you expound on that a little bit?
There's this gray area in American politics, and a lot of people don't know about it, and that is where campaign professionals become lobbyists, or they're lobbyists at the same time that they're campaign specialists. And it happens especially with the money. You work for a candidate, you work very hard to get them elected, you get very close to that candidate, and then after the election, there is a period where there's no campaigns going on and you have to do something as a professional and you become an advocate of policies from industry or for unions because people know that you're close to that candidate and they hire you to pitch the candidate on what they want. Or sometimes during the campaign they hire you at the same time that the candidate hires you. It's really a shade of gray. And there's very little regulation with respect to it. Many times, campaign specialists are also the heads of political action committees for members. They're the treasurers, as well as lobbyists. It's a world that people know in Washington. It's not a world that's written about very much, and most people don't know about it outside of Washington.
Republican Senator Susan Collins and Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman had proposed the creation of an Office of Public Integrity. What was their goal in proposing this, and what was the outcome?
The Office of Public Integrity proposal was there so that there would be more rigorous enforcement of existing law and ethics related to lobbying and also member behavior. It was a direct insult to the chair of the Ethics Committee in the Senate, Mr. Voinovich, a Republican from Ohio, but also the chair of the Ethics Committee in the House of Representatives, Doc Hastings, a Republican from the state of Washington. They felt they were doing a good job. Most people feel they were not doing a good job. They needed to create another institution that was objective, bipartisan, that had the resources to enforce existing law and to review travel and to have more transparency in the system. The old guard in the Senate didn't like it, and Collins, chair of the Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee, where the jurisdiction is over this issue, proposed it. Lieberman, ranking on that committee, was for it. He's a Democrat. We thought we had bipartisan support, but they lost overwhelmingly in committee. It has come up on the floor of the Senate again in the form of several amendments. It looks like it will fail.
What do you think the odds are that when the Senate and the House finally come together and agree on a bill for lobbying that will be a lobbying reform bill with teeth?
I think the probability is that we're going to have lobbying reform light this year. And that means they're not going to do very much. They're going to ban people that were members, former members that are now lobbyists from the gym. They've already done that in the House, or from the floor privileges. That has nothing to do with the problems that we have here. I think they're going to do very little in terms of enforcement, strengthening oversight, enhancing disclosure of lobbying, let alone curbing privately funded travel and gifts. I hope that we have reform, but I don't think we're going to have significant reform.
You want significant lobbying reform, but do you think there is a place where lobbying actually helps the American democracy?
Lobbying is not a bad word in my mind. I have lots of friends that are lobbyists. We have First Amendment rights here in this democracy. We have the right of assembly, to petition government, freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion. These things allow for the growth of groups. They allow for the growth of people who advocate particular positions. In fact, you can organize around anything in America as long as it's not a terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda or the Communist Party or Hamas. In fact, if you're a mother who tragically has lost a son in an accident caused by a drunken driver, you can create Mothers Against Drunk Driving in your local community, and it can spread to the county, the state, and nationally and have an impact on the recent surface transportation bill. I think that's right. That's the nature of our pluralist representative democracy. It's what makes it great. If there are people who have a particular grievance, they can organize and lobby. The problem is that we need more transparency, we need more oversight, we need to strengthen the existing enforcement of lobbying laws, and we need to cut out really excessive contributions from very wealthy people and corporations in terms of privately funded travel and gifts and other things that members are getting.
James Thurber, thank you very much for talking with us.
Yes, thank you.
James Thurber is a distinguished professor of government and director of the Center for Congressional and Presidential Studies at American University. Coming up, Hilma Wallitzer on being a novelist and the mother of a novelist. This is Fresh Air. Hilma Wallitzer's new novel, The Doctor's Daughter, begins as a middle-aged woman awakes with a feeling of dread and isn't sure what's causing it. Is it her marriage, her children, or her father's Alzheimer's disease? As the novel progresses, she examines her life for the answer. Wallitzer didn't publish her first novel until she was in her mid-40s. The Doctor's Daughter is her seventh novel, but it's the first she's written in more than a decade. The main character's father in The Doctor's Daughter is based in part on Wallitzer's parents, who both had dementia before they died. In the novel, the main character, Alice, describes herself as witnessing the gradual death of her father's personality. I asked Wallitzer if there were aspects of her parents' personalities that remained intact or became even more pronounced during the period of dementia.
The sweetness that my mother always exhibited became more pronounced. Even as she lost the ability to talk, it was in her facial expressions, the way she looked at me when I came into a room. You know, there was this brightness of recognition. Of course, that eventually faded, too. And my father, who was somewhat irritable, became more irritable. I saw that happen as well. And the main thing was is that you lose them twice. You lose the parent you knew and loved and depended upon. And then you learn to love the parent they become, the one who's dependent upon you. And then you get ready to lose that person, too.
Did this make you think a lot about which parts of personality are just innate to a person and which parts are shaped by everything around them, their upbringing, their environment, and so on? Because they're like,
yeah.
Your mother's sweetness, did you come to think that that was just something innate to her?
I think it was the way shyness is. There are certain things change according to in the environment of a nursing home, which isn't always conducive to feeling good about yourself. You're in a very public situation. You don't have the kind of privacy you had. So certain aspects of the deterioration of their personality was due to the environment, I think, to that lack of privacy, to exposure to other people having their own dementia, the kind of screaming that went on in that situation. It wasn't like home, for sure.
Did it hurt you to leave after a visit to the institution where they were?
It hurt me to come in and to leave. In the book, Alice cries when her father is being undressed and put to bed for the first time. She felt as if she had betrayed him in some terrible way. And I felt the same way. It happened that my father was very high and euphoric on antipsychotics, so I was in the hallway crying, and he was singing at the top of his lungs in the other room and seemed to be having a good time. So it sort of made me laugh a little and cry at the same time. But when I left them, I have to say, I felt very free and happy about resuming my own life, about going home, going to the library, reading a book, seeing my family, eating with sentient friends.
How much time had you spent caring for them before taking them to a 24-hour facility?
Well, only my father went to the 24-hour facility. My mother had a stroke, and I took care of them as they gradually deteriorated for about 17 years.
In your home,
and my father
or in
was,
their home?
It was in their home, and we arranged for caretakers, but I was on the scene as well and on the phone all the time as well. And the phone calls got really peculiar, as they do with Alice's father. They become more frequent, they become more repetitive, and then they start coming in the middle of the night. And that's when you really get scared.
Mm-hmm. You know, as much as she is upset when she brings her father to the nursing home, she decides to take him out one day for just like a little trip, a little visit. And things go so badly. And she's so overwhelmed by the responsibility and by his lack of ability to really get, be in the world, that she's so grateful when she returns him back home to the nursing home.
Yeah, I felt that way, too. We took my father out for a visit, to visit my mother, actually, and it was a very tragic situation. We got stuck in traffic. He thought he was in an elevator. He wanted to get out, and it was very similar. My book is not autobiographical. I'm not Alice. This isn't about my marriage, but there are certain details that I've taken from life, like the father's deterioration.
My guest is Hilma Wallitzer, and her new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. You published your first novel when you were 44, which is relatively late in life to have a first novel for somebody who goes on to become, you know, a really respected novelist. What made you decide so relatively late in life to write a novel?
I had been writing short stories and publishing them, but I erroneously believed that the short story was the adolescence of a writer and the novel was her maturity. So I tried to write a novel, and lo and behold, I did. But once I did that, it was very hard to go back to the short story. When that novel came out, I was really quite a dedicated domestic person. And in the print interviews I did, the headline read, "Housewife Turns Into Writer." And I was so worried after this 12-year hiatus that if I did any more interviews, it would say, "Writer turns back into housewife."
Well, what did you do for the 12 years you weren't writing?
A lot of reading. I'd like to say I went to medical school or that I had amnesia, but I'm afraid, you know, that's not true. I did a lot of anguishing about not writing. I woke up every day thinking, oh, no, another day without writing. And I would sit down at the typewriter and later the computer and try to write. And there were times I fell asleep doing it because I wasn't inspired. I didn't have a character telling me her story the way I did with this one.
So you'd sit down and feel like you were forcing it?
Uh-huh, exactly. I was forcing it. And if you don't want to write it, nobody's going to want to read it. It's when it comes out. This book came so quickly and so fluently that I feel that it was probably being written in some unconscious way, that I was writing, even though I wasn't putting it down.
My guest is writer Hilma Wallitzer. Her new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. Last year, I spoke with her daughter, Meg Wallitzer, who's also a writer and had just published her novel, The Position. It's about a family in which the young children find out their parents are the authors of a best-selling sex manual similar to The Joy of Sex. The novel follows the members of the family and examines how this book affects their lives. Here's a brief excerpt of that interview with Meg, in which I asked about her mother. Now, your mother is a writer, Hilma Wallitzer, and yes. I'm wondering, like, when you were young, did you come across sex scenes of hers, and what impact did that have on you?
Yes, that had an impact as well. I mean, these things all kind of came together in my mind to gestate for a long time until I wrote The Position. But when I was a teenager, in junior high school, actually, my mother sold her first novel, Ending, and it was a wonderful literary book, but it did have a pretty graphic sex scene in it. And I remember going to school that day, and a bunch of boys had a copy of the book. And they ran down the hallway shouting, "Read page 108, read page 108. And I pretty much went home to my mother and said, "Why couldn't you be a travel agent?" I mean, in the suburb where we lived, nobody's mother was a novelist. Everybody's mother was a travel agent or a real estate agent or a housewife. This was something pretty unusual that she did.
That's Meg Wallitzer talking about my guest, her mother, Hilma Wallitzer. And Hilma Wallitzer has a new novel called The Doctor's Daughter. Well, Hilma, did you worry about, well, what if my daughter reads this scene on page 108?
No, I didn't. I couldn't worry about all those things. Otherwise, you just stop writing. I remember my mother calling and saying, "Well, your novel is very nice, dear, but your aunts are going to be very upset about the language you use."
Did you care about what your aunts would think?
No, I didn't really.
And another thing that Meg says here that's really interesting is that when you're a kid, you want your mother to be like everybody else's mother. I think when you get older, you so appreciate what's unique about your parents. But, you know, when you're young, you want them to be like everyone else.
Well, I tried to be like everyone else in the important ways and the nurturing ways, but I had to be my own self. I had to be that writer. As soon as they went off to school, I went right to the typewriter in my bathrobe and had my secret life.
It sounds like maybe it took you a while before you gave yourself permission to do what you really wanted to do and to have that secret life.
Definitely. Definitely. And the women's movement had a great deal to do with it. It really did give me permission. I felt before that, if I talked about trying to write, I was be treated like a talented housewife. That same image came back into play. But once I published, everything changed. People took me more seriously. I remember telling my father about my first short story being published in the Saturday Evening Post, and he was deeply impressed. He said, "Why, I read that at the dentist."
So it kind of existed in his world.
Yes. Before that, it was just something I did when I wasn't cooking or talking on the phone to them, when I wasn't raising the children.
You said the women's movement helped you reach the point where you could say, "I want to write, and I'm going to try and do it." What aspect of the women's movement? Was it books that you read, a consciousness-raising group that you were in, just what was in the air? I mean, what was it exactly?
I didn't belong to a consciousness-raising group. It was The Feminine Mystique, which was a very important book in my development. I didn't belong to a consciousness-raising group, but Meg did. She and a group of little friends met at the house, and they wouldn't let me come in because I said, "Well, why not? I'm a woman, too." And they said, "Yes, but we talk about our mothers." That's what their consciousness-raising group was about, was complaining about their mothers.
How old was she then?
Oh, I guess she was a teenager, a young teenager.
So if it wasn't a consciousness-raising group, it was Betty Friedan's book, The Feminine Mystique.
Ms. Magazine. There was something in the air. People began talking about it, and I saw friends. I didn't know any other writers, but I saw friends restlessly looking for something else to do that wasn't making Jell-O, that wasn't just picking the kids up at school or going to brownie meetings. Everybody seemed to be looking for something else. And it's really odd because it was as if I broke a contract that I had made.
What kind of contract?
My mother had raised me to get married and have children.
But your children were pretty mature by then, right?
Well, they were in school when I started writing short stories. Mm-hmm. They were both in school. That seemed convenient. But even then, I was expected, or I thought I was expected, to be home doing certain things. And I was the mother who made costumes. I think my kids were really relieved when I finally became a full-time writer because I stopped forcing them to be the Headless Horseman, as the character is in my book, for Halloween when they just wanted that store-bought princess costume. And I was always decorating their birthday cakes until they collapsed. I think I was putting all that creative energy into my domestic life. And then when I put it all into my writing, I think everybody was relieved to have less attention paid to them, to have more freedom.
Was it fulfilling when you were putting it in your domestic life?
Yes, it actually was. And I have to say, this is probably sounds like a non-feminist thing to say, but when I'd clean a closet, for instance, I felt almost the same way I did as when I finished a short story. I had organized something in the short story, my thoughts in the closet, my blouses and skirts. I had cleaned out stuff I wasn't going to wear, which is equivalent to editing. There seemed to be an analogy.
I like that. My guest is Hilma Wallitzer. Her new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. She'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Hilma Wallitzer. Her new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. So when you decided you wanted to write, you took a writing workshop that was taught by Anatole Broyard, who is a great writer and later became a book critic for the New York Times. I think you studied with him before he'd become a book critic?
Yes, yes. He was amazing as a teacher, too, because when I came to that class, I had very little self-confidence. And what little I had was almost destroyed that first night. He had me come to the front of the class and read my short story aloud in a very crowded classroom at the New School in New York. And then he called on people for comments, and the first man said, "That was the most boring thing I ever heard in my life." And I was ready to pack it in, just go home and make Jell-O for the rest of my life. And Anatole slipped me a note, which I still have, and it said, "The story is fine. Congratulations. See me later." And he just said, "You don't belong in this class," and he put me into an advanced class, where I read the same story the following week. They didn't like it much either, but they said constructive and helpful things about it. And eventually I did publish that story.
Did you revise it a lot from the version that you'd read in class?
Yes, definitely. And revision is what workshops are about. I always tell my workshops the purpose of this class is revision, not suicide.
Yeah, that's really great. Great advice. Did you feel close to, like, packing it in after the criticisms you got that first time?
Definitely. I remember trembling. And really, first of all, it was very embarrassing to have to read my story aloud in front of all these people. Believe it or not, I was shy in those days. I don't think I could have yelled fire in a crowded theater without feeling self-conscious. And it was hard enough to do that, to finally do it. And I read it so quickly, I hyperventilated. And I read it just like a laundry list without any expression. And then to have it so brutally criticized. And I remember Anatole saying to the person who criticized it, "Well, wasn't there anything you liked?" And I thought, well, I don't want this guy to throw me a bone. That was the last thing I wanted. But what he was showing was how important it is to find whatever is good in a piece of work, so to encourage the writer to do more of that. Anybody could point out what's bad in it, but if you can find that one gem, that one good sentence in an otherwise lost story, you can help that writer to harness that and use it again.
I would imagine that, like most writing teachers and editors, he recommended that you always go for the truth of the story or the truth of the experience, the truth of the emotion, whether it was fiction or nonfiction that you were writing, to kind of go deep down to that larger truth. What was it like for you when you learned that he had kept a secret all his life? And the secret was that he was actually African-American passing for white. And I'm just wondering what your reaction to that was and when it was that you learned that.
Well, Skip Gates asked me that question before he was...
This is the writer Henry Louis Gates.
Yes, when he was writing his piece for The New Yorker about Anatole and about the exposure of his background. And in thinking about it, I realized I knew for years. I knew his sacred secret. And we just never talked about it because
he didn't want to talk about it.
I guess it was in the atmosphere. People talked about it. I had heard it.
So it was a kind of known secret.
Yes, it was a known secret. There was a novel in which he was supposedly exposed, where he was a character who tried to pass. And we all knew about it, but we didn't really discuss it very much. There was so much else that was important about him, that was vital about him to us, his intelligence, his generosity to us as students, his brilliance, his creativity, his own gift for writing. He wrote a wonderful story called What the Cystoscope Said. And Gates's premise was that he never developed fully as a writer, never went on to write the great novel that the early stories promised he would, because he was shielding that secret. But I tended to think that the block he had, and it was a kind of block or an inhibition, may have been due to something else, or he may just have wasted himself and wasted his talent in conversation because he was sparkling in the classroom.
Yeah, some people really say don't talk about what you're writing and don't maybe even talk too much while you're writing. Save it.
Right. Well, we always heard all those things. I don't know why I didn't write for 12 years. I'm not positive. It's felt like a terminal block. But as I said, I may have been writing all along, and I was living my life during that time. Life gets in the way, but I think that's kind of a whiny excuse, because I wrote during stressful or busy times before this. So I don't know what got in the way now, but I'm just so glad it's over. It's wonderful to be writing again.
Well, Hilma Wallitzer, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Hilma Wallitzer's new novel is called The Doctor's Daughter. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you'll also find a link to my interview with her daughter, novelist Meg Wallitzer. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Capella University, an accredited university offering bachelor's, MBA, master's, and doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. From Diane Wolfe of New York and Washington, D.C., in great appreciation of NPR's mission to create a more informed public. And from The Dial Press, publisher of Intuition, a novel by Allegra Goodman, author of Catterskill Falls. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The U.S. Comedy Arts Festival in Aspen is honoring TV director and executive producer James Burrows with a career tribute. He's best known for his work on Taxi, Cheers, Frasier, and Will and Grace. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Burrows. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.